CliffCentral.com. That's Dua Lipa with Future Nostalgia. CliffCentral.com. It is Tuesday. We're coming up to just after 7 o'clock. And a Tuesday morning, lots of things to talk about, lots of places to go, people to see, things to get stuck into. And if you want to get hold of us, 0797482090. A lot of people preparing their kids for school tomorrow. Some of the schools even opening today, I think.
The parents are very, very, very excited about this.
I know.
Yeah.
And that means that suddenly we're going to see a huge amount of traffic from tomorrow. A little bit earlier on, Dr. Ellie Rosen is going to join us. We're going to talk about comprehensive sex education in schools. This is a hugely controversial area. The debate on comprehensive sexuality education, which is a component of the life orientation curriculum in South African schools, is one that has been heating things up among parents of school-going kids. And we're going to talk to Ellie Rosen about exactly what that means. They'll be in here just after 7:30 this morning. Scientists at Harvard have identified the DNA switch that allows for whole body regeneration. You know, animals like salamanders and lizards and geckos, when they lose their tail, they can grow a new one?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, so they've found what part of the DNA allows them to do this.
Wait, but whole body regeneration.
Listen, jellyfish and sea anemones can even regenerate their entire bodies after being cut in half. The Harvard researchers have discovered a section of the non-coding or junk DNA in worms controls the early growth response genes. The master control gene acts like a switch that turns regeneration on or off. We were able to decrease the activity of this gene, found that if you don't have EGR, nothing happens. The animals just can't regenerate. All those downstream genes won't turn on, so other switches don't work, and the whole house goes dark, basically. The study, observing three banded panther worms and their regenerative abilities, has crucial applications to human biology. Humans also carry EGR, producing it in small quantities when cells are stressed. The findings push scientists to find a way to tweak the master gene in humans to improve our regenerative abilities.
So we can basically then, in a million years' time, grow an arm if we need to.
Wow.
If it gets chopped off.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So apparently the postdoctoral students who are working on this, led by Andrew Gecker, they say that the solution is the non-coding DNA controls the gene. And once it was believed that the stuff did nothing, junk DNA is now receiving more attention for its role in our biology. Only about 2% of the genome makes things like proteins. We wanted to know, what is the other 90% of the genome doing during whole body regeneration? So there's a whole lot more, and that story comes from the Intellectualist this morning. Isn't that fascinating?
Wow.
Imagine if we could regrow an arm.
But here's the thing. I'm imagining in 300 years' time, there'll be, like, teenage boys using this as a party trick.
Oh, yeah.
Cutting off the hand, and then it grows back.
Yeah. The new frat party trick.
No. That's immediately what you go to. I'm like trying to think of ways this could be used to help people who've been wounded in war, people who've lost their arms and
everything. Mine's like, if my hands are looking a bit wrinkly, I'll just chop one off and regrow a new one.
Oh, my goodness. You won't even need plastic surgery, per se.
No.
Because, wait, does it come out or does it grow as something younger?
No, so yeah, that we don't know.
It will be younger. So if you think of a lizard's tail, surely the stuff that grows out is brand new, fresh cells.
Yeah, but still, I don't think that's important. I think we've got
Gareth
a lot
is so disappointed that, by no, what we're
this so,
up.
This is puerile. Yes. Like, you're talking about whether it'll make you younger or not. It's such a first world problem in a world where
people have no legs.
If you don't feel
no
like taking off your toenail polish, just chop them off.
I'll be calling
like
in 300
years'
time.
Imagine people who've been really badly scarred in accidents, or people who've had, you know, terrible limbs cut off. Things crushed, you know. Horrible things happen to them, and this could be a lifeline.
I think about arthritic wrists and hands.
And obviously it's a long, long way before we figure out exactly how to do this, but that they've discovered this switch in the genes in what they thought was junk DNA is incredible.
Mm.
Sorry, guys, I'm running late. I'm just growing another hand.
Yeah. I can't make the tennis this weekend, but if you give me another 3 weeks, I'll be there with my new hand.
I'll have to have Olympics rules and sports rules and check if your legs are brand new or...
Yeah, grow a new penis.
Hey.
Yeah.
It's
new titties.
No. Ooh, new young titties.
Yes.
Oh.
That. Now we're jumping straight to the really good stuff.
Now, how else are you going to prepare for date night? Okay, brush my teeth, get some perfume on, hack off my old tits.
Yeah, grow some new ones. Yeah, that's great.
No, I'm not happy with this size. Let's do it again.
All right.
This is actually really cool.
Let's talk a little bit about the crazy stuff going on in the weather all over the world. Someone sent me a picture yesterday of New York, and at the Lincoln Center, there's knee-deep water, which is a bit odd. Venice, of course, had flooding not so long ago, and everybody was worried that the whole place...
2 months ago, they had flooding.
And now, apparently, the canals are dry.
Yeah.
So there's something... everybody goes, oh, it's climate proof, there's climate change.
Yeah.
I don't want to get taken by all of this, but it is a little.
It's very odd.
Yeah.
And the pictures are so weird. It's weird to see Venice looking like this.
Yeah.
And also what's scary is all the sludge at the bottom of these canals you're now finding.
Yeah.
Because it's basically exceptionally low tide and everything is being revealed.
Mm-hmm. And it's revolting.
And obviously this is a huge way of getting around Venice, is navigating these canals.
Sure.
And that has now been taken away. So it's now, I mean, and think of all the people who've booked holidays to Venice and have dreamed of going there all their lives, and what they're going to see is going to be a completely different city.
Yeah. So now by the way, they say it's because of low tides. It's not because there isn't... rain.
Yeah, it's not, as far as I know, it's not being blamed on climate change as much as we think it is.
So low tides pull all the water out of Venice, but it's left with a sludge at the bottom of it.
Yeah, it's not great at the moment. Too.
Ooh,
yeah.
There's nothing romantic about that.
No.
Yeah.
Don't plan a proposal, don't do anything.
And the thing is that they're just getting over all those floods, and damage from those floods was estimated over $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So the city's basically in a state of shock at the moment.
Yes. All right, very good.
Jeez.
So what else is going on, Leanne Moll?
Well, remember we spoke yesterday about Jeff Bezos's donation to the Australian fires.
That people are up in arms over
Everybody's telling everybody else what to do with their money that they didn't earn.
So he pledged $1 million.
Yes.
Which amounts to about 690,000 American dollars.
Mm-hmm.
0.60 and then a 9% of his annual income. So to think that that'll be refreshed the next year. Anywho, somebody's donated almost as much to the recovery, and that's Metallica.
Yes, well, Gord actually mentioned that the other day because he's, of course, as you know, a huge Metallica fan. And yes, the band Metallica gave a very substantial donation.
$750,000.
And are people saying, oh, F you, Metallica, it's not enough?
No, they're not. It's like, it's completely what you said. It's how much you decide to donate is your business.
Yeah, but some people think that because they know how much you're worth, they will decide how much you should give. It's just unbelievable. People who've got no money at all are telling people who do have money how much they should give. Go out and make your own money.
All the judgments, really. Yeah. The Queen had her big meeting yesterday with Harry and Meghan.
Oh, right.
And William, but Meghan would have been online because she's still in Canada. And she's agreed to let Harry and Meghan move part-time to Canada. So that's like the first step. She's saying... She wholeheartedly understands their point of view and understands why they would want to withdraw.
Yeah.
And she, over the next few days, has to try and figure out how this is going to work from both sides, how they can reach an agreement somewhere in the middle. But in the meantime, just yesterday, she's agreed that the two can live part-time in Canada.
Now, but hold up. This is the biggest story that I feel like people aren't talking about. Meghan Markle's sister has been banned off Twitter.
No, but she was just, that was one of your big things.
Yes.
You were one of the few people who she allowed to follow her.
Yes.
I'm so sorry, Sia.
This is heartbreaking to me. I think I was like one of 4,000 of her followers. She's been suspended and now her...
Why? Was she abusive?
Her Twitter account does not exist anymore.
Sia, how did you find out?
I was trying to go into Samantha Markle's Twitter account to find out what she has to say, because I'm sure she should have been tweeting up a storm over the past couple of days. But her account at Sammy_Markle doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I'm so disappointed. Mm. Where else are we going to hear about the debauchery of the Markle family now? So this isn't fun.
I'm sorry, poor Samantha. Mm. Now she's got nowhere to sprout her nastiness.
Where will she roll into my life now? Literally.
So what does this mean?
This is her official statement. My family and I are entirely supportive of Harry and Meghan's desire to create a new life as a young family. Although we would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family, we respect and understand their wish to live a more independent life as a family while remaining a valued part of my family.
My favorite part, my favorite line that I heard yesterday was from someone from Prince Charles's camp saying, just a word of warning to the couple, they don't have unlimited resources and Harry needs to know that. So you know, I think that's the father in him going, do all you want, but just know that I'm not forking out your entire lifestyle here.
What's quite interesting is that usually the Queen in this statement would refer to them as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, but she called them either my grandson and his family or Harry and Meghan. So she's even taking it that far to acknowledge that perhaps they don't even want those titles.
Sure.
Well, everything is calculated at this
point, so
I'm not
surprised.
Some
people who just do not give a rat's ass about the royal family.
Mm, of course.
And they find all of this so boring. But you know what it is? It's like if people talk about their families and you know their family. It's an interesting story because you know the characters. It's like a soap opera played out on a much smaller stage. And this is obviously a soap opera played out on a much bigger stage. So even if you don't care about the royal family, it's interesting from a human dynamics point of view. And we all try to imagine what we would be like, admit it, come on, if you were extremely rich or extremely powerful or extremely famous, you came from a fancy family, a grand family who, you know, over thousands of years had the kind of power and influence that they have.
Mm. Oh, I wouldn't want that for my family. Mm-mm.
Oh, you mean Aunt Tabitha would be a problem? You'd have to send her to Canada?
You know, at least there's, three people that Meghan just has to be aware of. The father, Samantha, and the half-brother. Oh, my family. I'll have to have so much payout money to pay people to keep quiet.
Well, on the issue of the canals in Venice drying out because of tides, apparently Dubai International was closed this weekend due to flooding.
Sure.
There was so much rain in Dubai.
In the desert.
Yeah. Apparently they had to close the airport. And everybody's been talking about how much water they've had in Abu Dhabi and Dubai over the last while. That's interesting stuff. So certainly some very bizarre and freakish things happening. I looked up, two of my friends live in Calgary in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know what the temperature there is? I want to see if it's got better.
Oh, no.
No, it's frightening. You we don't know cold.
Two friends of mine have just immigrated. They immigrated. They are 2 weeks into their stay.
And they're in Canada?
Yeah.
Well, here it is. Vancouver is currently -6, which is not so bad, but it's not great.
Mm.
Calgary, -27 degrees.
Okay.
Partly cloudy. Wind chill brings it down to -27.
All right.
How's that, huh? You can't do anything. And by the way, their forecast temperatures for the rest of this week, tomorrow -26, then Thursday -24, Friday -21, Saturday -14. That's what you got to look forward to if you live in Calgary in Canada. Isn't that exciting?
Meanwhile, nice. In the Alaskan wilderness, which is just as snowy and cold, a man has been found there after surviving for 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
In the cold.
This is the guy who scratched SOS into the snow?
So he's actually from Utah, right? He went into the Alaskan wilderness and he had this, he'd actually bought like a secondhand wartime tent.
Yeah.
And one day he woke up, he'd lit a fire, right?
Yeah.
He woke up and the tent was burning down. There were like gloopy drops of plastic falling into the tent. He jumped out of the tent. Unfortunately, his chocolate lab was still inside and didn't make it out. And he said he could hear his screams. And that part of the story I'll never forget.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Anyway, he wrote SOS with the debris into the snow. And he's finally been rescued. But he survived off of a couple of tins of food that he had. No shelter in this absolutely freezing cold weather.
My God.
Pretty crazy.
He saved, though.
What was he doing there in the first place?
Yeah. Look, if you're going to live in these extreme places, I don't know that it's fair to expect everyone else to fetch you and help you when things go wrong.
And also, I don't know, Guy, you bought something called a Quonset hut, which is a lightweight frame covered in plastic tarps that he bought from a Vietnam veteran.
And then he goes and lives in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
And you see, this is what irritates me about people like that, is they think they're being adventurous and they're exciting and they're such cool people. And maybe they are. But the fact that they have to then rely on everyone else to save them when it doesn't go right, I think that's very irresponsible. I think it's also quite self-centered.
Mm.
Like suddenly everyone else has to climb into helicopters at great expense, scour the wilderness to try to find you. And when they do find you, they have to rescue you. Again, putting their own lives at risk, perhaps, and going to great lengths, just seems like a very selfish way to live.
Yeah.
You know? Do your adventuring in the back garden. And keep it at that, for heaven's sake. In a temperate zone. Don't go into the Canadian wilderness. Alaskan wilderness. I mean, that temperature I just gave you for Calgary, it's 1 degree colder than Antarctica. Okay? Not necessary to live in places like that, really. I'm trying to prove.
Yeah.
All right, very good. What else is going on?
Well, this is going to take a while to happen.
Okay.
But a Mars...
Let me put on the kettle.
A Mars sample is busy returning to Earth.
How long is a while?
10 years.
Oh, can't wait 10 years.
But in the meantime, scientists have gotten together and thought, we need to actually prepare the public before this happens.
Prepare us for what?
Apparently, they're concerned by the fact that there might be real life out there. And humans have thought this for so long. And they feel like they don't want people to be caught off guard. They said there will probably be considerable fear, anxiety, and confusion. So the members of the International Mars Sample Return Team need to start educating and engaging lay people about the effort now.
Well, in case we can't handle this, there might be
so
other life out there.
This is making me wonder, they know something, obviously, that we don't.
Well.
They said some people will worry that the samples could harbor some sort of infectious microbe that could get loose and unleash a deadly plague on humanity.
Yeah, then don't bring it back.
Because now you're worried too.
Well, I don't want some horrible microbe taking, mind you. All right, do the experiment up in outer space on the space station first. And if people on the space station catch something, then blow the whole thing up.
So what's going to actually happen is after arriving on Earth, the Mars material will first be vetted at a special sample receiving facility, which will be designed to prevent contamination from both directions.
All right.
So nothing unwanted will get into the tent and vice versa. It hasn't been built, but the site has been chosen. And they say the public needs to know that such safety measures will be taken.
Huh. Sounds very complicated. I think it's not worth the trouble. First of all, it's going to take very long.
It's 10 years, decades
away. I wasn't even able to wait till Christmas when I was a kid for a present. So there's no way I'm going to wait 10 years. Second of all, the danger of these microbes. I'm not worried about whether there's life out there or not. There probably is. But if it's going to kill us, keep it away.
Mm.
And as much as I'm inquisitive, just like the next guy. I want to know what Mars is made up of. I want to know what there is there. I want to see an analysis of some of these samples. But can't they do it in the International Space Station? And then if things get out of control, like in Sigourney Weaver's Alien,
yes,
and there are things, right, in Mbulelo, you've seen those movies.
I have.
But that thing that punches through someone's stomach.
Yes. I like your idea. We should all vote for one family member we don't like, and they should all have to go to that space station.
There's not enough space for all of them.
Ah.
Not enough. We can use the people who are already there.
Fair enough.
But also, people don't really care until it actually happens. I mean, are you going to remember this for the next 9 years?
Some people will be. They're going to be working on it.
Mm-hmm.
No, but you, as a human who's scared of perhaps being infected by something on planet Earth.
Yeah, probably not.
I think that they should just not bother. Don't tell us. Just do it.
Just carry on. Yeah. Don't prepare us. Yeah, instead of preparing us, maybe we don't want to know.
Yeah, and the longer you give us to prepare, the more questions we're going to have and the more panicky we're going to get. So just do it. You were doing fine.
Yeah.
We don't want to know.
I'm thinking of that alien with Sigourney Weaver.
Oh.
It lays eggs or whatever it does. It eats. It goes on the face of a person and then.
And also, we were quite young when that came out, so it's left an impression.
Big time.
Yeah.
Classic film.
And then they fall down, and this thing comes punching out of their stomach. And
oh.
And it's got like a mouth within a mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, millions and millions of teeth.
Oh.
Happy about this, actually.
It's just a tiny sample they're bringing back. It'll be fine.
It'll be fine, yeah.
It'll be fine. That's always how the horror movie starts. We're just approaching Earth now. We've got the sample in tow. We're coming into orbit. We can hear you. Everything's cool. You're commencing your re-entry now. Can you hear us? Spacecraft, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Something's wrong.
Oh, no.
We can detect biological life on board. Seems everybody's alive. Everything's fine.
Okay.
Come on.
Alrighty.
Look behind you.
Jesus. I don't want that. Please, can we just... Oh, you've put me in a... Like,
that's why they should have... I should not have said anything, but neither should they have.
Gareth,
get on with this.
With all these freakish weather events, you still think climate change is a hoax, really, really? Well, listen.
Oh, you started something.
Good job. I'm just not one of these people who's fanatical about this thing. Like, I hear people all over the world losing their minds about it. They tried to blame these Australian fires on climate change. It's actually just huge, irresponsible, massive, over-regulating government. And... the fact that the place is flammable. I mean, who was it that wrote recently? I think it was Jeremy Clarkson who wrote an article. Basically said, Australia is uninhabitable. People should just get out of it. Oh. It's like the International Space Station after an alien has taken it over. It's hilarious. Hey, guys, I spoke to a friend of mine in the Grand Prairie yesterday. Minus 45 degrees.
Ha! Huh. Oof.
Hmm. And then this is Leighton who says, it's me. I hate that I have had to hear about the stupid royal assholes for a week now. But a lot of people very unhappy about
Don't
it.
Don't worry. In like 3 more days, this will all have died down.
Yeah.
Articles like Sir Elton John acknowledged for taking up a motherly role to Prince Harry.
And is that what he's doing?
I saw that yesterday and I thought, oh, people are now taking a piss. And I think the people of Sussex have never been so famous in their lives. I saw a bulletin with some people in Sussex and I'm like, no, people, this is really not affecting you that much. It's not changing the price of your bread.
Me. Attention for me. Cory Booker has suspended his presidential campaign. You didn't even know he was in, right?
No.
He says, it's with a full heart that I share this news. I've made the hard decision to suspend my campaign for president. I've said throughout this race that this election is not just a referendum on Donald Trump. It's a referendum on who we are and who we must be to each other. And over the past year, I've seen the very best of who we can be. Tell me where you saw the very best of who you could be. At which Democratic debate, which one of those debates had any positive impact on anything? I'd love to know.
Another one bites the dust.
To my team, my supporters, and everyone who gave me a shot, thank you. I'm so proud of what we built. What? Nothing. Because you've just set it all on fire and walked away. I feel nothing but faith in what we can accomplish together. You haven't accomplished anything. That's why you've stopped your campaign. Can we please be honest in our language? Cory Booker, you're an utter failure. You never got above 2% in the polls. 2%! It was sheer hubris and egomania that even made you think that you could run in the presidential elections. So now it's down to what? Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden. Who else is there? Tulsi Gabbard is still in there somewhere. Amy Klobuchar. Pete Buttigieg. I think that's it. I think that's who we've got. Because Kamala Harris is out. Cory Booker's out now. So everybody's okay. So excited.
Yeah, there are 12 Democrats and three Republicans 12. Left.
Still 12? Tell me who the other ones I left out.
Okay, so you mentioned Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Mayor Pete. Then there's Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, yes, of course.
Andrew Yang, a New York entrepreneur and former tech executive.
Yeah, he's the one who talks about universal basic income the whole time.
Yeah, he's 45 years old and he wants to guarantee all Americans between 18 and 64 a $1,000 check every month.
Cool.
There's an Amy, what's her surname?
Klobuchar.
That one. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Senator from Minnesota. Tulsi Gabbard. There's Tom Steyer, a billionaire environmentalist.
Steyer.
John Delaney.
Hmm.
The former U.S. Delaney. Representative from Maryland became the first Democrat to enter the 2020 race. There's Michael Bennett. There's Deval Patrick. Yeah, and that's all 12. Some of these people, I swear, I've never heard of ever. And then the Republicans, there's President Trump, Joe Walsh, and Bill Weld, 74 years old.
Well, yeah. Trump is who's Trump excited about any of them?
Excited about the 74-year-old.
Well, touching on something that we haven't really discussed in a while here on the show, the college admission scandals.
Oh, when the last time we spoke about it was when Ricky Gervais at the Golden Globe said that his license plate on the limo he took was made by Felicity Huffman.
Yeah.
That was the last time we spoke about that.
I don't think we even covered the fact that Felicity Huffman went to prison and was released.
Yes, she's back out in the real world. Lock up your children, everybody. Make sure that you get your armed guards at the gate because the dangerous felon... Felicity Huffman is back on the loose.
Yeah, she just spent 11 days in total in prison.
It was only 11 days?
It was only 11
days. How long it takes to make a number plate.
That was the one skill she learned, and then she was done. She paid her $30,000 fine. Yes. And then, as of yesterday, she started her 250 hours of court-mandated community service. So she's living her best life.
I wonder what she'll be doing.
Gardening.
Picking up dirt on the side of the road.
Well, what did she do in Desperate Housewives? Wasn't she the one who was always out in the garden with a little spade?
She's working with the Teen Project in Los Angeles, and that is an organization that serves homeless and sex trafficked young women, many of whom come from
foster care. That sounds horrible. Bad for her. That's a horrible thing to have to do.
She'll learn more from that than she would have learned spending time in prison, I think.
But then here's the other one who we haven't mentioned in a while.
She's the one from Full House.
Lori Loughlin.
Lori Loughlin.
Now,
right.
This is why I love money.
Now, she's the daughter. She's the one whose daughter was the famous YouTuber who was basically bunking college and didn't really care about college. Olivia or something.
Yeah.
She didn't give a shit about college, and her parents were like, "You've got to go to college because you're a numbskull who's only got YouTube. And if they suddenly decide they're going to shut down your YouTube account, then we're going to have to support you for the rest of your useless life. You wastrel." Well, that's not what they said. They said, our daughter's going to get in because we're going to bribe whoever we have to bribe to get her in.
Yeah, true.
And we'll lie on her admissions papers.
But not according
to... And we'll never be caught.
Not according to their lawyers. And this is why I love money. What's that great quote. I think it's from Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. Scratch that. With great money comes great possibility.
Yes, go on.
Because Laurie's lawyers have actually been building what I think is quite a watertight case.
Okay.
They have followed all of the money that is alleged by Laurie to have been bribed. These school members. And they are saying, actually, if you follow the money closely, none of this directly points to the fact that we are bribing anyone in particular. No, 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 no. So they, for example, say that a chunk of the money, $50,000 US, was paid directly into the university. And their lawyers are defending that, saying, no, that was just their donation to the school. They believe in the school, they believe in the university and what it's all about, and that's how.
Oh, so they're just going to get away with it by just
donating
that. It's just our philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take it or leave it.
There's also a $200,000 US check that was made out to one of the top leaders of the school by Laurie and her husband.
How much?
$200,000 US. It was made out to the Key Worldwide Foundation. This is a non-profit organization that is known to be supported by one of the top leaders at the school. And the lawyers are saying, excuse me, so are you now saying that our clients are not allowed to save the world? They believe in this foundation, and that is exactly why they're donating the money. And then there's been a continuous $20,000 US amount that has been going into the athletics department and also another charitable foundation. But the lawyers are defending this, saying this money was made after both their daughters were accepted to the university. So they're saying we couldn't possibly be bribing them. We couldn't be bribing anyone because our daughters were already accepted into the school. So now we're just merely continuing with our charitable donations. Fuck, I love money. Yeah. It's so useless, but I love money. This is what you pay good lawyers for. And I totally think this story is not true at all. But it's also alleged that Lori Loughlin has hired a prison expert to teach her how to survive behind bars.
Oh, my word.
If she
You're
ends
kidding
up
me.
Doing time.
Do you know that there are YouTube Ridiculous. Clips from people who have been in prison mm-hmm. you can go and watch that will prepare you for prison
if you
go to jail. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that American?
Yeah.
So part of this prison...
I wonder...
No, in South Africa, I think it's a total different
game. Different story, yeah.
Part of what this prison expert supposedly is teaching Laurie is that she needs to know things like table manners in prison. She needs to know how to conduct herself socially in prison. She needs to understand eye contact and who to look at in the eye and who not to look at in the eye. Hmm. How to shake hands in prison and how, you know, shaking hands could be, you know, confused a bit,
like,
and you could end up, yeah. I'm like, seriously, this is
a secret prison handshake.
I totally don't think that this is true, but anyway.
All right. Well, we've got a guest who's going to pop in and help us out with some stuff that we picked up on in the news. The debate on comprehensive sexuality education, which is a component of the life orientation curriculum in South African schools, been a very controversial subject among parents of school-going kids. I think we can all agree that there is an urgent need to increase and improve the amount of quality, comprehensive sexual education.
Hugely.
At schools, because we have people who just don't understand.
It's actually not even, even a lot is not enough. Mm.
Yeah, but whose responsibility is it? Because we know we have derelict parents who can't teach kids anything. There are a lot of parents in this country who are just really shit at being parents. So if there are parents who can't do it, should that responsibility be taken on by schools? Because otherwise these kids grow up not knowing a damn thing and they become a problem to the rest of us. You know, it's obviously something worth thinking about. Who could possibly be against this? Well, Dr. Ellie Rosen is a medically trained sex educator. Their focus is on promoting access to healthcare for all people through education, both the patient and the healthcare provider. They're here to tell us more about CSE, but specifically who some of the people and organizations are that are opposing this. So, Ellie, welcome. First of all, it is Ellie, right?
It's Eli.
Eli. You see, I asked Sia to find out for me. Shit. Sorry, Eli. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Gareth.
Cool. So tell me, have I outlined the problem here in a very basic sense, that comprehensive sexual education at schools is a massively touchy subject for some people? But it shouldn't really be. It has to form part of basic education.
I think what we need to understand is that a lot of parents are coming to this from a place of concern out of love for their kid.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
That's the first step. The first step to understanding why people are as upset about it as what they are. And that quite often they are working on an assumption about what CSE actually is without actually knowing what comprehensive sex education actually entails.
Okay.
And they often think that this is something that is going to sexualize their children, that it's going to give kids, if we give kids information about sex, they're going to want to go out and do it.
Mm. It's like, don't put those ideas in their head.
Absolutely.
They'll do it.
As if they never have these conversations with friends of theirs at school.
Let's keep kids as ignorant as possible because that's going to keep them safe. But all the research and absolutely everything that has been done around sexuality of children says that when we empower children with information, that they're able to make better decisions about
sure.
their sexual well-being, and they are actually making a choice about their sexuality that is more deliberate and more informed. And I always say, you know, we mustn't think that ignorance and innocence are the same thing.
Correct.
Kids can have information and stay innocent because they're more likely to be intentional about what they're doing rather than ending up in situations that they didn't expect where things happened too fast, too overwhelmingly, and they weren't able to stop it before they actually got into that situation because they never saw it coming.
I can understand that the mindset, though. I mean, if I just think back to myself, I was in a 13-year-long relationship from the age of 13. And my mom approached me and said, I think that we need to get you onto the pill.
Oh.
And I was not sexually active at the time. And as soon as she said that, I thought maybe I should be. And so I did become.
Oh. Well, that's an interesting story, but I don't know that that's necessarily.
No, and obviously there wasn't an education and informing element to
yeah.
that whole thing.
I mean,
so it was just a fleeting mind.
How much different would it have been for you if your mom had actually sat you down in that moment and said, well, listen, this is your options as far as your relationship is concerned, and don't ever feel that you have to be pressured into doing something that you're not ready for and that you're not comfortable for about.
Well, this will come as a shocker, but she was from an era where she felt it was a duty for a woman to be like that with a man.
Jeez.
She even said to me, you know, he's not going to stay around for that long if you aren't sexually active with him.
Wow.
Whoa.
Mm.
Wait, how old
That's
were you when she said that?
Very, very strange and archaic.
I was probably 16.
Shucks.
Damn.
Yeah. So that exists. It's not a fallacy.
Absolutely. And we all come to our sexuality from our unique backgrounds.
Sure.
With all the information that we have about how the world works and how relationships work. And we all come to, like, these discussions about sexuality with a lot of baggage. So some of it includes these, like, really sexist ideas of what relationships are and how they work and how we are supposed to behave within relationships and what's expected.
Yeah, and there are bad traditional ideas, and there are some that are supposedly meant to protect people. But really, there's also a lot of shame attached to sex. For some people, some parents, they're just incapable of talking to their kids about this stuff, honestly.
Absolutely.
Sometimes there's way too much pressure on the school to have to teach kids everything because the parents just have nothing to do with them. Or there's the opposite end, where the parents say, I don't want the school to have anything to do with teaching my kid about this stuff. I will do it, and I'll do it my way. This is a really tough road to navigate, right?
Yeah, it is. And being able to hold every child in their reality within a school environment takes a certain amount of skill, it takes practice, and it takes a lot of awareness. And this actually is where my biggest concern about comprehensive sex education being under the guise of life orientation comes in, because we are expecting life orientation teachers to take over this function of being a sex educator without any further training, with the support being these scripted lesson plans that were released last year. But essentially, quite often the ALO teacher comes from a psychology background, but definitely not a medical background, definitely not a sex education background, definitely not a comprehensive sex education background, and definitely not a background where they're actually able to navigate these social complexities around sexuality. I mean, this is what I do day in and day out.
Yeah,
and
but, but we don't have 5 million of you.
We don't have 5 million of me. And that really is means that we do need more people doing it. But what I would prefer to see is having somebody like me come in and be the district sex educator and do the sex ed for all the schools in a certain district.
So tell me what.
And have specialistly trained sex educators navigating these topics and supporting the school.
Who are you arguing with at the moment? I mean, who are the people who are on the other side of what you're saying? And what is their argument?
I think there is a combination of people who are concerned parents. I think that is the biggest group of people out there who I don't think we're even arguing. I think quite often we've got the exact same motivations. We want the well-being for kids, front and foremost. But how we're going to approach that differs. And we have the parents who are like, I would rather do this at home. But we need to understand that not every child has access to an adult who has the information about sex, the law in South Africa, we've got complex consent laws, we've got complex laws around access to abortion, we've got complex law around access to healthcare, and most parents do not have that information in order to pass it on to their children.
So Eli, what about government? I mean, what is their take on all of this?
So, written into the Children's Act, every child has a right to health care, and in that health care, sexual and reproductive health care is included, which means that every child over the age of 12 has a legal right to accurate information about their sexual and reproductive health, which means that even in a school environment, a school would be able to provide sex ed to the children in that school without having to get the permission of the parents involved, because the child has a legal right to that information without parental consent, which means a child who had to go to a clinic for HIV testing, for accessing contraceptives, to access condoms, would be able to do that already under the law of South Africa without having to get their parents' consent to do so.
Do you think that that's a good piece of legislation? I mean, you're in favor of it? Or do you think maybe the age should be slightly higher or slightly younger? Are you satisfied with that being the law? If you could, in an ideal world, have redone the legislation, would you redo it in any different way?
Well, the legislation also has a preamble which says that it does not support early sex at all in any form, and that children should be given the information that they need in order to make their decisions about their sexual health first and foremost. So our very, very first obligation as adults in South African society is to make sure that children are empowered with knowledge.
And that goes against a lot of cultures in South Africa where, you know, it's a right to adulthood. They're calling it that, but it's at the age of 13 that kids are having sex in order to keep with the traditions.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, like, if we think about, like, what sexualizes children and how children become sexually active, we have kids who are accessing pornography from about the age of 9. Like, I go into schools and I'm talking to a group of, it would be grade 8s. And I say, how many of you have smartphones? And they all put up their hands.
Yeah.
And then I say to them, how many of you have had your parents have a conversation with you about boundaries, what you're allowed to use the smartphone for and what you're not allowed to use it for? How many of your parents have told you that you're not allowed to look at porn on your cell phone? And I think I've had one child put their hand up in a class of 35. Okay, so we assume that kids understand the boundaries, and we assume that kids know what's right and wrong, but we also avoiding having these conversations because we don't want to sexualize children. But in fact, what we're doing is we're actually opening them up to a world of vulnerability because we're not giving them the opportunity to engage critically with these topics before they end up with their friend showing them something or sharing explicit content on a group WhatsApp message, which happens far more often than you would believe.
Sure, it's such a minefield, though. What are they covering in CSE in the different grades at the moment?
Okay, so it depends on if you're looking at those scripted lesson plans.
Yeah.
In the earlier age groups, it's a lot more about body function. This is what my body is. This is how it works.
Yeah.
This is the introduction to basic concepts. And then as you get older, it becomes more nuanced. You start having conversations about risk, about behavior. But also one of the biggest parts of CSE is talking about relationships and how are we sexual citizenship, how are we sexual citizens in the context of society? Because we're not sexual beings alone. We aren't isolated from the rest of society. And how do we move into our sexuality in a way that actually is healthy for everybody involved? So we start looking at relationships, we start looking at the more complex topics around gender and sexuality, around same-sex relationships. We start looking at topics around like all the touchy stuff, like masturbation, access to termination of pregnancies, all of these really the necessary conversations to have that I think people often shy away from because they're not sure how to actually even start the conversation. But you'll see that all of these build on top of each other, right? None of these, I think quite often people feel like they want to take one of these topics out of context of this larger conversation and get stressed out about this one topic.
Yeah.
And they forget that this is not something that is going to be spoken about every week in life orientation and that they're only going to be having these conversations around masturbation. And it's going to be for 45 minutes a week, every week for like the next 12 years. And in fact, it's actually more likely to be about 45 minutes.
I know some people who could have benefited from having those conversations for 45 minutes.
Yeah,
and more likely it's actually going to be a couple of hours a term building on the knowledge base, which is then expanded over years to become more nuanced and more give a bit more information as children mature and grow into their understandings of these things.
What are the best practices worldwide? I mean, do we have the life orientation and then the comprehensive sex education stuff come from any other countries? Or which countries are we looking at in terms of successes? And Sia, do you remember what you learned at school? In terms of this stuff.
I learned it all at school because this just speaks to the type of parenting I had, though. One of probably the only sex talks my parents and I have ever had was my dad sitting me down in the lounge, and I was probably in like grade two, and he says, so you talk about sex at school, right? I was like, yep. So he says, do you have any questions? I'm like, nope. He says, okay, you can go now. And then I got up and left. So really for me, like everything was discussed and was never crude. It was never crass. It was a holistic approach to learning about sex. And I'm grateful for that, actually.
Leanne, do you remember what you learned?
Yeah, my mom bought me two books.
Oh, no.
The reason why she bought them was because we were just driving in the car and I was thinking about things. And I mentioned that it must be really painful for an elephant to give birth. I said, can you imagine the pain of that coming through your bum? And that's when she realized I needed a book because they weren't coming out the bum.
Right.
So she gave me two books. And they had actual photographs of actual pubic hair and kids growing up and the phases and boobs and different sizes. And I was like, I was so grateful that she didn't have to sit with me and go through it. I could just do it myself. And then we didn't speak after that because that was just enough.
You remember yours?
My mom's very, very open. And she's obviously a medical professional, so of the mind. So she, very open from very early.
Okay.
Yeah, and my mom's got no holds barred. No,
so she was just like, here are the facts, get with it.
No, let's... yeah.
And you, Gareth?
I don't really remember. I mean, I think that at school we had some kind of sex education, and they give you those horrible, like, diagrams of what people looked like if you did them in cross-section. You know what I mean?
I do.
But also we covered a lot of it in biology.
Yeah.
But it was a different time. Our teachers... I mean, I've just got a question for Dr. Rosen. So we obviously live in a religious country, right? And I mean, this is a conversation nobody ever wants to have, how demonized the notion of sex is within that space. And we live in a Christian-Judean country, whether we like it or not, our framework is there. So do you face any challenges with those particular institutions, with, I mean, by South African standards, what you're talking about is revolutionary, right? I would imagine.
Well, you would think so, but the funny thing is that this conversation can be contextualized for each child.
Mm.
This conversation needs to hold the religious child in their belief system, in their value system, in their own morality. But we can't only have the conversation for the religious child. We also need to have the conversation for the sexually active child. We also have to have the conversation for the child with a disability.
Mm.
We also need to have the conversation for the LGBTI child. We also need to have the conversation for the child who has come from a child-headed household and does not have an adult in the house to ask these
questions. By the
questions.
Way, if I never wanted to have kids before, you've just given me extra reasons to not want to have them.
Right?
God.
And we need to hold everybody's reality.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to have this conversation sensitively for every single child. And yes, that takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of practice. But I don't think it's impossible. And when we do have this very religious background, we can still have a conversation about how does your body function?
Yeah.
What is it that you're looking for from a relationship? Just because you get married does not automatically mean that the relationship that you're going to be in is going to be a healthy relationship, or that you are not going to end up in some sort of toxic situation. It does not mean that you're going to be protected from gender-based violence.
Mm.
It doesn't mean that any of these things are automatically going to be taken off the table. So we still need to have in-depth conversations about what relationships look like, what a healthy relationship is, how does sex fit into a relationship, what is right for you. And that is always my take-home message. What is right for you? Because we need to have children making decisions about their sexuality when the teachers, preachers and parents aren't there.
Yeah. All right, well, Eli, I've got a couple of questions here. Riet wants to know, apart from the obvious medical and physical information, does the sex education include the positive aspects of sex? How to know and explore your body without shame, how to have pleasure responsibly and legally? And number two, how can you be trained as a sex educator for the purposes of this system?
So currently there is no one institution that's doing any sort of sex education degree or anything like this. I ended up falling into it because of my medical background and the fact that I worked with my business partner who was a nurse who was doing essentially family planning since the mid-90s. And through working with kids and asking them, what do you want to know, we developed this curriculum. Now, in 2015, I think it was, the World Association of Sexual Health wrote up the Madrid Consensus document, which was basically a document which looked at what needs to be included in a sex education curriculum in order to make it comprehensive, and that it would actually help children be able to navigate their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is when we looked at the curriculum that we had developed organically through the questions of children, we found that it aligned absolutely perfectly with this world standard from the World Sexual Health Association, which means that if we actually just ask kids, what do you need to know, we are already taking a step forward into being able to provide them the information that they really need in order to make their decisions.
Mm.
Because if we don't answer those questions, where are they going to get that information from? They're going to get it from their peers and the internet.
And obviously you say there isn't one body that governs all of this stuff. But if people wanted to get involved in sex education, I mean, again, there are probably certain qualifications, and there's a certain amount of time that needs to be spent figuring these things out with professionals.
Absolutely. So if you are looking to get into sex education, you can either go from a medical background, which is where my background is, or you can go from a public health background. Mm. One of my other facilitators has a degree in public health. You can also come in from a psychosocial background, so a psychology degree or something like that. But I would recommend getting involved with the various different sexual health organizations in South Africa, organizations like SASHA, the South African Sexual Health Association. There is also an African Sexual Health organization. So there are existing organizations who are working in the field of sexual health.
And that first question about positive, you know, sexual health and kind of exploring your body, knowing what the limits are, knowing what the legal
pleasure is often one of the things that isn't talked about in sex education, because we want to medicalize it, right? We want to say
it becomes so sterile.
We want to take this idea of, okay, if we only give kids the basic medical information, they'll figure the rest out by themselves.
They won't be as intrigued.
But if we ask kids, why do people have sex? Why do people have sex? What answers do we get?
What do you get?
Because it's fun.
Mm.
Yeah.
They know. They know that there's pleasure. They know that people are doing it because it is something that they want to do, because there is an exploration, there's a curiosity, there's a enjoyment factor. So it's not like they don't understand this already. So talking about pleasure, talking about knowing how your body works, because your body is different to everybody else's body, and everybody's map to pleasure looks different. And the only way you can actually figure out what your map looks like is by actually figuring out by yourself. And so masturbation is one of the ways that kids can learn how to use their explore their sexual body in a way that is safe. There is no sexual risk. There is no STI risk. There is no pregnancy risk, you know, and they can actually start being curious about their sexual health and how they work as a human being without feeling that they have to automatically get involved with another person in order to experience that. It means that they're able to kind of take ownership of that part of themselves without feeling like there is a time limit or a ticking clock that's going to expire, and that if they don't do this thing now, they're never going to have another opportunity, because I see a lot of that with young people.
No, it's also quite interesting. You made me remember something else now from these books that were given to me. At the time, my mom was trying to raise me as a Christian, and she was trying very hard.
Hallelujah.
And these books were written by Christians, and masturbation wasn't mentioned in these books.
Well, you know what, that's always one of those conversations that's, again, a touchy topic, because from a religious perspective, there are a whole bunch of understandings about masturbation being wrong. But quite often when we look at this religious perspective, it conflates pornography use and masturbation. And we start seeing these, like, they take the context of normal body exploration, normal body touch, that happens as part of a child's sexual development. And this is a well-documented thing. This is not something that is being sucked out of the thumb. You know, we know this about children. We know that they have curiosity about their genitals. They're able to feel pleasure in their genitals from the time that they are absolutely tiny, from the time that they are babies. As a matter of fact, fetuses have been having erections and having vaginal wetness in the uterus. You know, I mean, like, before they were even born. This is not a new thing. But when we actually start having this conversation about what masturbation is, everybody always wants to jump into, my kids are going to be watching porn and they're going to be masturbating obsessively, and absolutely not. That's not what masturbation should be for a child. First of all, they should not be accessing pornography at the age of 12, 13, 14 years old. The legal side of that is that kids are only allowed to access porn once they are no longer kids. You know, you have to be over the age of 18 to access porn. our age of consent in South Africa is 16. So you would be able to have sex before you're allowed to access porn by law.
Mm. Oh,
put that into perspective. Yeah. So now when we actually have conversations about like religious side of things, we can also say this is something that some people choose to do and it's not going to cause any harm for you to do it and it's not going to cause any harm for you not to do it. And it is your own personal choice as to whether or not you decide to masturbate. But I always add in a sexual health component. If you do choose to masturbate, it's a great time to learn how to use lubricants and condoms because the first time you need a condom shouldn't be the first time that you're trying to put one on, right?
How bad is the state of sexual education and how ignorant are kids in this country generally, based on your experience now?
Okay, so I think a lot of parents say we want to do this at home. But whenever I go into a class, I ask for questions. Sometimes I get them anonymously ahead of time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get them in the class because it's a dynamic conversation, right? And things will pop up. And if every parent was doing sex ed at home, I would not have a job. I would not have questions. I would not have kids asking me things when I do a sex ed intervention.
Mm. And it's not only kids. I mean, 40-year-olds.
How often do I have the teachers coming to me afterwards and saying, I had no idea what a menstrual cup was. Can you show me a little bit closer how those work?
Yeah.
Oh, it's time for me to wake up.
So, Dr. Risen, am I being too simplistic to say we should completely be pushing things like religion out of the way so we can actually get the sort of stuff, because it does not get in the way of such great work, or is that too simplistic a way to look at it?
I don't think we can separate these things out because religion fundamentally underpins how people experience their sexuality, and I think that is very valid. I think everybody...
And you can't be determining someone else's value system.
No, but I mean, in the classroom, when we're teaching... Okay, but
you could, I trust the government a whole lot less if I were a parent than you do. But it seems to me like what you're saying is it's complicated. You have to weigh up all of these things and try to accommodate as much of it as possible.
Absolutely, and we need to make sure that kids are able to understand these complexities within their own selves. Mm-hmm. Because how often do we have a child who says, like, well, I came from a very religious background and my parents were trying to raise me as this super orthodox person, but my own experience of myself went contrary to what I was taught at home.
Yeah.
And therefore, instead of being able to integrate these two different things, I had to reject one or the other. And we don't want that schism. We don't want people having to tear themselves in half to be able to navigate their sexuality. We want people to integrate a healthy sex life, a healthy sexuality, a healthy understanding of their own selves, as well as their backgrounds, their religion, their moral system, their values, what their parents have told them, what society tells them. But at the same time, still having that critical voice that says, this thing that I heard does not apply to me, or this thing that I heard actually causes me harm. So therefore, I can choose not to engage with this one thing that is contrary to who I need to be as a person.
Mm.
Well, I'm glad that there is someone who's busy taking an active interest in this and spurring forward what I hope will help kids to be less ignorant and help parents also to be less ignorant and teachers, so we can all just figure out the most healthy way forward. I mean, in the end, all you want is a bunch of young people who are confident about themselves, who are not given bad information, who are not misled by any people or in authority.
Who don't think they're evil.
Who don't think they're evil and who also are not taught things that they shouldn't be taught at an inappropriate age. It's a very, very difficult field to be able to find general consensus in. So good luck.
I don't think there will ever be consensus there will always be concerns and stress. But I think that we can definitely move into the future with a little bit more... of an open mind, and the fact that sexuality exists whether we agree with it or not.
Absolutely.
And that this is something that needs to be spoken about.
Do you want to quickly tell us about Sexy Smarts in case people want to find out more about your organization?
Absolutely. Sexy Smarts is our sex ed consultancy, and we work in South African schools all across the country. It was started early in the 90s by our founder, Sister Ruth. She has actually just retired. She will have put in her final hours as far
so not
as...
not Dr. Ruth, but Sister Ruth.
Sister Ruth, Sister Ruth, okay. Yes.
And not Nun Sister.
No, this is Nurse Sister, yes. She's actually a nursing sister and worked as a midwife for a very long time, and through doing family planning ended up going into sex ed. She always tells a story about when she first realized that sex ed was something that she needed to do. She had somebody come in and she said, if I could answer any question that you have without any sort of judgment, what would that question be? And the girl sitting in front of her said, can you get pregnant from oral sex? Can you get pregnant from a blowjob? Okay, and then she realized that this is a conversation that needs to actually be had, because there are so many people with these questions.
Yeah.
And yes, so
now
can
you? I'm on tenterhooks.
You know, if you're lightning fast and you can do acrobatic tricks, it might be possible.
Well, I always tell kids, you know, there's the reproductive system and then there's the pizza system. Any semen going into the pizza system, which is the tube from the mouth all the way through to the anus, is not going to cause a baby. However, any semen going into the reproductive system, which is anywhere from the outside of the vulva all the way through into the vagina, can cause a pregnancy if there is an egg waiting to be fertilized.
Dun, dun, dun.
And there we go. Okay. How to answer that question without being...
We finally worked it out.
The pizza system versus the reproductive system.
All right. See, that's the way to do it.
Okay. No more pregnancy scares for me.
Well, Dr. Eli Rosen, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you for being part of the show. It is just after 8 o'clock, cliffcentral.com. We will see you tomorrow morning, bright and early. CliffCentral.com